Chapter 4. He really owed his preservation to me, because for one entire hour I stood between him and certain death. The boys would have killed him, if they could have got by me. By and by, when the company were far in the rear, I put away my pipe. I was getting fearfully dry, and crisp about the gills and rather blown with good diligent work, and spurred my animated trance up alongside the Arab, and stopped him, and asked for water. He unslung his little gourd-shaped earthenware jug, and I put it under my mustache, and took a long, glorious, satisfying draught. I was going to scour the mouth of the jug a little, but I saw that I had brought the whole train together once more by my delay, and that they were all anxious to drink too, and would have been long ago, if the Arab had not pretended that he was out of water. So I hastened to pass the vessel to Davis. He took a mouthful, and never said a word, but climbed off his horse, and lay down calmly in the road. I felt sorry for Davis. It was too late now, though, and Dan was drinking. Dan got down too, and hunted for a soft place. I thought I heard Dan say that Arab's friends ought to keep him in alcohol or else take him out and bury him somewhere. All the boys took a drink and climbed down. It is not well to go into further particulars. Let us draw the curtain upon this act. Well, now, to think that after three changing years I should hear from that curious old relic again, and see Dan advertising it for sale for the benefit of a benevolent object. Dan is not treating that present right. I gave that pipe to him for a keepsake. However, he probably finds that it keeps away custom and interferes with business. It is the most convincing inanimate object in all this part of the world, perhaps. Dan and I were roommates in all that long Uakar City voyage, and whenever I desired to have a little season of privacy I used to fire up on that pipe and persuade Dan to go out, and he seldom waited to change his clothes either. In about a quarter, or from that to three quarters of a minute, he would be propping up the smokestack on the upper deck and cursing. I wonder how the faithful old relic is going to sell? A reminiscence of the back settlements, now that corpse, said the undertaker, patting the folded hands of the deceased approvingly, was a brick every way you took him, he was a brick. He was so real accommodating, and so modest-like and simple in his last moments. Friends wanted metallic burial case, nothing else would do. I couldn't get it. There weren't going to be time anybody could see that. Corpse said never mind, shake him up some kind of a box he could stretch out in comfortable, he weren't particular about the general style of it. Said he went more on room than style, anyway, in the last final container. Friends wanted a silver door plate on the coffin, signifying who he was, and where he was from. Now you know a fellow couldn't roust out such a gaily thing as that in a little country town like this. What did Corpse say? Corpse said, whitewash his old canoe and daub his address, and general destination onto it with a blacking brush and a stencil plate, along with a verse from some likely hymn or other, and paint him for the tomb, and mark him 100. Oh, D, and just let him skip along. He weren't distressed any more than you be, on the contrary, just as calm, and collected as a hearse horse. Said he judged that where he was going to, a body would find it considerable better to attract attention by a picturesque moral character than a natty burial case with a swell door plate on it. Splendid man, he was. I'd rather do for a corpse like that than any I've tackled in 7 year. There's some satisfaction in burying a man like that. You feel that what you're doing is appreciated. Lord bless you, so's he got planted before he spilled, he was perfectly satisfied. Said his relations meant well, perfectly well, but all them preparations was bound to delay the thing more or less, and he didn't wish to be kept laying round. You never see such a clear head as what he had, and so calm and so cool. Just a hunk of brains, that is what he was. Perfectly awful. It was a ripping distance from one end of that man's head to t'other. Often and over again he's had brain fever raging in one place, and the rest of the pile didn't know anything about it, didn't affect it any more than an engine insurrection in Arizona affects the Atlantic states. Well, the relations they wanted a big funeral, but Corpse said he was down on flummery, didn't want any procession, fill the hearse full of mourners, and get out a stern line, and tow him behind. He was the most down on style of any remains I ever struck. A beautiful, simple-minded creature, it was what he was, you can depend on that. He was just set on having things the way he wanted them, and he took a solid comfort in laying his little plans. He had me measure him, and take a whole raft of directions. Then he had a minister stand up behind a long box with a tablecloth over it, and read his funeral sermon, saying anchor, anchor, apostrophe, apostrophe at the good places, and making him scratch out every bit of brag about him, and all the hephaliotin. And then he made them trot out the choir so's he could help them pick out the tunes for the occasion, and he got them to sing Pop Goes the Weasel, apostrophe because he'd always liked that tune when he was downhearted, and solemn music made him sad. And when they sung that with tears in their eyes because they all loved him, and his relations grieving around, he just laid there as happy as a bug, and trying to beat time and showing all over how much he enjoyed it. And presently he got worked up and excited, and tried to join in, for mind you, he was pretty proud of his abilities in the singing line. But the first time he opened his mouth, and was just going to spread himself, his breath took a walk. I never see a man snuffed out so sudden. Ah, it was a great loss, it was a powerful loss to this poor little one-horse town. Well, 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 I ain't got time to be palavering along here, got to nail on the lid and mosey along with him, and if he'll just give me a lift we'll skeet him into the hearse and meander along. Relations bound to have it so don't pay no attention to dying injunctions, minute a corpse is gone. But if I had my way, if I didn't respect his last wishes, and tow him behind the hearse, I'll be cussed. I consider that whatever a corpse wants done for his comfort is a little enough matter, and a man ain't got no right to deceive him, or take advantage of him, and whatever a corpse trusts me to do I'm a-going to do, you know, even if it's to stuff him, and paint him yaller, and keep him for a keepsake, you hear me? He cracked his whip, and went lumbering away with his ancient ruin of a hearse, and I continued my walk with a valuable lesson learned that a healthy and wholesome cheerfulness is not necessarily impossible to any occupation. The lesson is likely to be lasting, for it will take many months to obliterate the memory of the remarks and circumstances that impressed it. A royal compliment, the latest report about the Spanish crown is, that it will now be offered to Prince Alfonso, the second son of the King of Portugal, who is but 5 years of age. The Spaniards have hunted through all the nations of Europe for a king. They tried to get a Portuguese in the person of Dom Luis, who is an old ex-monarch. They tried to get an Italian, in the person of Victor Emmanuel's young son, the Duke of Genoa. They tried to get a Spaniard, in the person of Espartero, who is an octogenarian. Some of them desired a French Bourbon, Montpensier. Some of them a Spanish Bourbon, the Prince of Asturias. Some of them an English Prince, one of the sons of Queen Victoria. They have just tried to get the German Prince Leopold, but they have thought it better to give him up than take a war along with him. It is a long time since we first suggested to them to try an American ruler. We can offer them a large number of able and experienced sovereigns to pick from, men skilled in statesmanship, versed in the science of government, and adepts in all the arts of administration, men who could wear the crown with dignity and rule the kingdom at a reasonable expense. There is not the least danger of Napoleon threatening them if they take an American sovereign. In fact, we have no doubt he would be pleased to support such a candidature. We are unwilling to mention names, though we have a man in our eye whom we wish they had in theirs. New York Tribune. It would be but an ostentation of modesty to permit such a pointed reference to myself to pass unnoticed. This is the second time that the Tribune, no doubt sincerely looking to the best interests of Spain and the world at large, has done me the great and unusual honor to propose me as a fit person to fill the Spanish throne. Why the Tribune should single me out in this way from the midst of a dozen Americans of higher political prominence is a problem which I cannot solve. Beyond a somewhat intimate knowledge of Spanish history and a profound veneration for its great names and illustrious deeds, I feel that I possess no merit that should peculiarly recommend me to this royal distinction. I cannot deny that Spanish history has always been mother's milk to me. I am proud of every Spanish achievement, from Hernando Cort's victory at Thermopylae down to Vasco Nunez de Balboa's discovery of the Atlantic Ocean, and of every splendid Spanish name, from Don Quixote and the Duke of Wellington down to Don Cesar de Bazan. However, these little graces of erudition are of small consequence, being more showy than serviceable. In case the Spanish scepter is pressed upon me and the indications unquestionably are that it will be, I shall feel it necessary to have certain things set down and distinctly understood beforehand. For instance, my salary must be paid quarterly in advance. In these unsettled times it will not do to trust. If Isabella had adopted this plan, she would be roosting on her ancestral throne today, for the simple reason that her subjects never could have raised 3 months of a royal salary in advance, and of course they could not have discharged her until they had squared up with her. My salary must be paid in gold. When greenbacks are fresh in a country, they are too fluctuating. My salary has got to be put at the ruling market rate. I am not going to cut under on the trade, and they are not going to trail me a long way from home, and then practice on my ignorance, and play me for a Royal North Adams Chinaman, by any means. As I understand it, imported kings generally get 5 millions a year and house rent free. Young George of Greece gets that. As the revenues only yield 2 millions, he has to take the national note for considerable. But even with things in that sort of shape, he is better fixed than he was in Denmark, where he had to eternally stand up, because he had no throne to sit on, and had to give bail for his board, because a royal apprentice gets no salary there while he is learning his trade. England is the place for that. $50,000 a year Great Britain pays on each royal child that is born, and this is increased from year to year as the child becomes more and more indispensable to his country. Look at Prince Arthur. At first he only got the usual birth bounty, but now that he has got so that he can dance, there is simply no telling what wages he gets. I should have to stipulate that the Spanish people wash more and endeavor to get along with less quarantine. Do you know, Spain keeps her ports fast locked against foreign traffic 3/4 of each year, because one day she is scared about the cholera, and the next about the plague, and next the measles, next the whooping cough, the hives, and the rash, but she does not mind leonine leprosy and elephantiasis any more than a great and enlightened civilization minds freckles. Soap would soon remove her anxious distress about foreign distempers. The reason arable land is so scarce in Spain is because the people squander so much of it on their persons, and then when they die it is improvidently buried with them. I should feel obliged to stipulate that Marshal Serrano be reduced to the rank of constable, or even roundsman. He is no longer fit to be city marshal. A man who refused to be king because he was too old and feeble is ill qualified to help sick people to the station house when they are armed, and their form of delirium tremens is of the exuberant and demonstrative kind. I should also require that a force be sent to chase the late Queen Isabella out of France. Her presence there can work no advantage to Spain, and she ought to be made to move at once, though, poor thing, she has been chased enough heretofore for a Spanish woman. I should also require that I am at this moment authoritatively informed that the Tribune did not mean me after all. Very well, I do not care 2 cents. The approaching epidemic, one calamity to which the death of Mr. Dickens dooms this country, has not awakened the concern to which its gravity entitles it. We refer to the fact that the nation is to be lectured to death, and read to death all next winter, by Tom, Dick, and Harry, with poor lamented Dickens for a pretext. All the vagabonds who can spell will afflict the people with readings from Pickwick and Copperfield, and all the insignificants who have been ennobled by the notice of the great novelist, or transfigured by his smile, will make a marketable commodity of it now, and turn the sacred reminiscence to the practical use of procuring bread and butter. The lecture rostrums will fairly swarm with these fortunates. Already the signs of it are perceptible. Behold how the unclean creatures are wending toward the dead lion and gathering to the feast. Reminiscences of Dickens. A lecture. By John Smith, who heard him read 8 times. Remembrances of Charles Dickens. A lecture. By John Jones, who saw him once in a streetcar, and twice in a barbershop. Recollections of Mr. Dickens. A lecture. By John Brown, who gained a wide fame by writing deliriously appreciative critiques and rhapsodies upon the great author's public readings, and who shook hands with the great author upon various occasions, and held converse with him several times. Readings from Dickens. By John White, who has the great delineator's style and manner perfectly, having attended all his readings in this country, and made these things a study, always practicing each reading before retiring, and while it was hot from the great delineator's lips. Upon this occasion Mr. W. will exhibit the remains of a cigar which he saw Mr. Dickens smoke. This relic is kept in a solid silver box made purposely for it. Sights and Sounds of the Great Novelist. A popular lecture. By John Gray, who waited on his table all the time he was at the Grand Hotel, New York, and still has in his possession, and will exhibit to the audience a fragment of the last piece of bread which the lamented author tasted in this country. Heart Treasures of Precious Moments with Literature's Departed Monarch. A lecture. By Miss Serena Amelia Trefenia McSpadden, who still wears, and will always wear, a glove upon the hand made sacred by the clasp of Dickens. Only death shall remove it. Readings from Dickens. By Mrs. J. O'Hooligan Murphy, who washed for him. Familiar Talks with the Great Author. A narrative lecture. By John Thomas, for 2 weeks his valet in America. And so forth, and so on. This isn't half the list. The man who has a toothpick once used by Charles Dickens will have to have a hearing, and the man who rode in an omnibus with Charles Dickens, and the lady to whom Charles Dickens granted the hospitalities of his umbrella during a storm, and the person who accesses a hole which once belonged in a handkerchief owned by Charles Dickens. Be patient and long-suffering, good people, for even this does not fill up the measure of what you must endure next winter. There is no creature in all this land who has had any personal relations with the late Mr. Dickens, however slight or trivial, but will shoulder his way to the rostrum and inflict his testimony upon his helpless countrymen. To some people it is fatal to be noticed by greatness. The tone imparting committee, I get old and ponderously respectable, only one thing will be able to make me truly happy, and that will be, to be put on the venerable tone-. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.